Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. Also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, Corlin Economics Report. Please be sure to check out our daily editorials to keep up to date on market moves, day-to-day market moves, as well as company updates. A lot of the companies that we follow still trying to provide some sort of clarity in terms of what they are going to do this year to, unfortunately, buck general downtrends that we've seen almost in every sector. We're kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. This is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail or individual side, Rick writes in the No Trader and a piece called 7-11, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs with the goal to beat the S&P. Rick, let's start with the S&P because I kept on hearing over the last few weeks that, look, the market is due for a bounce. It got into some oversold conditions, and a lot of commentators were saying that this should be, whether it's a dead cat bounce, bear market rally, there should be some upward moves here in early summer. Over the past about 5 weeks, we've seen a little bounce, but boy, oh boy, it is not exciting. And even this last week, ending Friday on a fairly positive note, the market still very much flat to slightly down for the week. This bounce doesn't seem very strong to me. What's your takeaway from all these comments about a bounce being overdue for these markets?
Well, the bounce, I don't know if I'd say it's overdue because we got a bounce off of the lows that we made in early June, and we got a couple hundred S&P points on the bounce. It's just that it kind of stalled against first level resistance from the models we use, and we come back down, you know, and tucked under 3,800 or so. And the thing is, if you look at just a basic chart, the last 4 weeks or so virtually have the same low. And it was 5 weeks ago that, wait, let me count, including this week. Yeah, four weeks in a row of pretty much the same low. And then we had the lows for the whole year at 36, 37 was the low. So far, bulls have defended the low of the year. And months ago, we were out with an estimated, you know, our target low was 36.17. We got 20 points from that. And as I said, bounced a few hundred, gave a good chunk of that back. And kind of right now we're at 38.50 and kind of in the middle of what we've seen over the last month. So it's gotten some price action. In the bigger kind of structural sense, we need to see a few Friday closes in a row above 39.07. And the more week ending closes above there, the better chance that you can get a leg up to play with perhaps even what were the spring highs, you know, closer to 41.50. That comes into play if we can get above 39.07. But last week's high was right there. The week before was pretty darn close. This week's high is 38.81. So as much as the bulls want to see this bounce, right now they're still not in control until you get some Friday closes above 39.07. Then you can at least say the bulls have something to lean on and hope that the lows that we've seen stay the lows, at least for now. I'm not convinced that the current low of the year is going to stay the low. In fact, I'm more apt in thinking it won't. But a lot of times in a bear market, some of the biggest bull moves are short squeezes in a bear market. And I'd still say that in the grand picture of things, I'd be looking to sell rallies into resistance levels. And there are multiple ones because we've been selling off for 7 months. But once you get kind of north of 41.50, I'm going to be much more inclined to be a seller than I am to be a buyer. So strategically, I'm still playing this as a bearish market that potentially has a bigger down move to go over time. Short term, I'm being bounded by 3907 on the top and about roughly 3700 or so on the bottom. And until we break either way from there, I'm not really going to care much about the 200 points in between. That's pure tactical short-term trading. But for the funds I speak to, and of course the individual investor clients I have from In the Know Trader, we're looking for moves beyond 3907 or under 3800 to more decidedly position for the next bigger move coming.
Well, Rick, you're not alone in being concerned that once we get up, maybe even a little higher to resistance, that there probably will be another rollover and leg lower. We've had a lot of guests on our show that feel the same way, and some are looking to get short again if we see even one of those short covering rallies that you mentioned. One question I have, Rick, is, you know, over the last 2 years, we saw so many new traders come into the market. When people were stuck at home, there was so much new money. There was a number of new trading platforms that even opened up and started and had all these new subscribers, and a lot of that money got evaporated. And not just over the last 7 months this year, but really starting the middle of last year, with the meme stocks blew up in February last year. Some of the stay-at-home stocks blew up in the summer of last year. And in the third and fourth quarter, we saw a lot of the growth tech stocks start giving up the ghost way before the major indexes did. Is it possible that so much money has gone to money heaven here that there's just not the supply of new capital to give a lift to these markets at this point?
Well, it's amazing how much money is actually always out there and potentially available to invest. Now, the new money that came in, which is now generally all underwater, is going to discourage some of those players into either playing this game again and or wondering how stacked it is to the average individual investor to get ahead. But also, if new money came in this late into what was a very strong bull market, you have to know that you're taking far above average risk when you come into a market with new money as either a first-time investor or somebody adding money in this deep into a bull market. And if you think about it, it's really first quarter of 2021, probably February or March, that the market actually topped in the sense of breadth and you know, your NASDAQ stocks, your average NASDAQ stock, not the FANG and the really big large cap names, but your average NASDAQ stock topped in first quarter last year and is already in a year and a half decline. That's part of, if you think about the whole concept that I've spoken to you and your audience about before, that we are generally a counter trend. I have taken in my 40 plus year career on the street at some of the with positions at some of the best firms on the street in very high level positions. For instance, you know, for years I was chief market strategist at Morgan Stanley. What I introduced to those clients and people who followed me was the whole idea of counter trend trading and investing doing so. And it's a much tougher game to play than trying to play with the trend. But this is a perfect example of, if one can identify when a trend is likely ending before it's obvious to the crowd, like now everybody can say, oh, yeah, we're in a bear market. You know, it's more about trying to identify the next meaningful turn before it's obvious to everybody else so that you're positioned for it. In the second week in January, I told clients the game's over. We broke, I think. It might have been, so maybe entering the third week, I think it was January 17th that I declared the game's over. And it's understanding where you are within the realm of a trend is the most important thing I think one can do. Because it's easy to be a buyer when everybody's buying. You're playing a bull market, let's say, and just jumping in and playing along with everybody else. And that's fine. And that's how most people make money. But if you can't identify when that is changing and act accordingly, then you face these type declines of 20%+ in the S&P and 30%+ in the NASDAQ. And, you know, you quickly see profits or trades erode into substantial losses very quickly. And what that does psychologically to an investor is very painful, both psychologically as well as monetarily. And if you think of basic math, when something sells off 25%, if the market then rallies 25%, you're not back to breaking even. You need a 33% rally to get back to where you were when the market sells off 25%. So people have a lot that they're going to have to deal with looking at what the market's done, certainly since, let's say, the S&P peaked essentially January 1st this year, and the Qs, you know, the QQQ, similar, it peaked a couple months earlier. But if you look at the average stock, it's way earlier, and people have really substantial losses, sometimes 40 to 70%. You know, that happened very quickly in people getting into, oh, look, the market's going up. Everybody's telling me I should get in. I'm finally going to get in. And when they do, you know, they make money for a month and say, this is great. And then all of a sudden it's gone and gone big and quickly. So I'm always looking at the big picture to make sure we know where we are within a trend, as well as the key levels that are truly meaningful to institutional investors as being where they are likely to add or take money out of the markets from. And the thing that most individual investors don't realize is that the models, the indicators they're using are generally not what institutions are using. So I do presentations all the time at conferences. And of course, I have my own weekly webinar, the In the Know Trader webinar, which, by the way, guys, I've just finished my association with Stock Charts and I've started my own YouTube channel. So you can go to look up In the Know Trader on YouTube. And I've just started my own channel. The first show will be on January 26th. And in these conversations I have, these webinars that I put out, I'll often, or in front of a hotel room of you know, individual investors at the money show or trading summits or places that I speak at, I'll say, raise your hand if you look at the RSI. And, you know, virtually every hand goes up. Raise your hand if you look at Bollinger Bands. Okay, most hands go up. And stochastics and moving averages and this and that. I said, guess what? It's the institutional community, by and large, doesn't care at all about these indicators. They're not making major portfolio decisions because a stochastics gets oversold. You think they're buying simply because of that? That's not what they're looking at. So the average investor is using tools that the institutional portfolio manager is not using or caring about. And it's no wonder that individual investors are often on the wrong side of the market, because they're actually providing some of the liquidity that institutions need in order to get out of their positions. Because a company that's a large money manager, they may have several million shares of a stock. It could take them a week or two to roll out of that name. They can't just put in an order and say, sell 2 million shares of Netflix at the market. You know, they have to work those orders in over a couple of weeks, change and flip their position. It's so important for the average investor to understand what the models are and have access to the indicators that institutions actually care about. And it's why I've been able to, months before we got there, tell you how important 3617 was going to be. It's why over the last few weeks I've been telling you 3907 is an important number. These are different models than most people look at and have a much better chance of actually identifying what the institutional community is going to do. And from somebody who's doing this over 40 years, I can tell you, you want to generally be aligned with what institutions are doing, not what the average individual investor is doing. Not if you want to get ahead over time.
That's fascinating, Rick. And unfortunately, we keep hearing institutional money, that's the smart money. Retail money, unfortunately, that's sometimes the dumb money. And they're a bit late in all of the cycles, whether it's on the downside or on the upside. So in terms of models that a lot of retail investors aren't privy to, what sectors do you like within the markets?
So right now, I'll give you a few of them. So in that 7-Eleven report that you mentioned, my goal in that report is to beat the S&P by being at no more than 7 of the 11 macro spider ETFs like XLK, XLE, XLB, XLY, et cetera, the 11 macro sectors of the market. A few of them that we're overweight right now include tech, financials. I'm overweight, but just a slight overweight. I'm very heavily overweight healthcare, and I'm overweight energy, but we cut energy by 30% exposure on June 1st, which was perfect timing because energy has gotten decimated. It's still the best performer this year, but it's gotten decimated over the last couple months as oil went from $120 a barrel down to $90 a barrel. So I still have an overweight in energy, but it is considerably smaller than it was a few months back.
Well, Rick, you brought up healthcare there, and we've had a couple people come on our show and mention that in an environment where we may have a recession backdrop or we're already in the recession currently, that healthcare tends to be a good sector to be in. I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that just from a macro sense. How does healthcare fare in the kind of situation we find ourselves in?
Well, healthcare has been outperforming. We moved into healthcare. So I started 7-Eleven in August of 2020, and I did not have healthcare in there until December 1st of last year. December 1st last year, healthcare was about, 30%, no more than 30% of the price of the S&P. So in other words, XLV, the healthcare ETF, was about 29.5% of the price of the S&P. It's now about 34%. So it's moved up dramatically since December. It's a sector that's done very well this year, and it's classically a defensive sector. Again, understanding how to shift money at the turn before it's obvious to everybody else is what allowed me to get in December 1st while it still looked lousy. And yet, now we've hugely outperformed, at least in our exposure to that sector, because we have an overweight type of we're overweight the sector now. It's not a surprise to see healthcare outperform when the market generally has some difficulties. It's classically a defensive sector, like utilities, like staples, like some of the other ones are. But biotech had gotten so badly beaten down that when I started looking at some of the subsectors within XLV healthcare, I noticed that most of them were showing me enough kind of downside exhaustion signals that I felt the risk was, it was the right time to take the chance to come in. Although we haven't gotten to the peak performance of outperformance in relative terms to where it got to in March of 2020 when COVID first hit and healthcare really outperformed, we are more than three quarters of the way towards that peak, and I'm kind of, I like healthcare. Now, if the market gets a strong rebound, healthcare may not outperform. You might very well see a move back into tech and consumer discretionary, which has gotten battered. But if the rally that could come ends up being just a rally to get out shorts, try to drag some new money in, but not be what the mega bulls are saying, which is that we're going to have a really strong second half of the year and the economy is going to grow and earnings will do well. And, look, there's some guys on the street strategists you hear who are saying this is the buy of a lifetime. I don't think so. I think that if the market can recoup several hundred S&P points, again, I'm more apt to be a seller, thinking that there's still very likely another leg to fall and send things lower. So it's never clear. There's nothing, you know, in stone. When you're a strategist like I am, you gather your data and you do your best to guesstimate what comes next. In general, you know, we have a tendency, I'm saying we collectively, I have a tendency of doing this fairly well in the sense that the 7-Eleven report, right? The goal to be the S&P is almost every money manager's, there's some benchmark that every money manager has, more have to the S&P than any other benchmark. We know historically that less than 1 in 7 successfully can beat the S&P over time. That's how hard it is to beat the market, which is why there's plenty of proponents who say, just invest in spiders and Qs and, you know, passive indexing, because active money managers can't beat the market. So July, the end of this month, will conclude our second year of the 7-Eleven report. And since we started through June 30th, I'm outperforming the S&P by 761 basis points in less than 2 years. I'm basically adding about 30 bips a month in outperformance. And I have a lower standard deviation than the S&P over the same time with higher returns. So my Sharpe ratio is 4 with the S&P at 2.45. So you can beat the market if you've got the right tools, the right experience, and, you know, some know-how. This, you know, why are we in healthcare? Because we could see the likelihood that the downtrend had ended while it was still, let's call it, in the ninth inning of the downtrend. So it's not obvious that it's over yet, but I was using the tools and the metrics I do, I was able to do this. And we try to do this across the sectors to stay with the outperformers and avoid the underperformers. And if you can avoid the underperformers, you will beat the S&P. That, you know, mathematics, that's as simple as it is. If you can avoid the underperformers, you will beat the S&P. And that's what we do.
That's so true. Avoid the falling sectors, avoid some of the ones that unfortunately people just get stuck into. Rick, I know that we're running a bit shorter on time here, so I want to switch over to the gold sector. Big picture, gold has actually held up okay this year when you do year-to-date numbers. Problem is, the gold stocks have been in pretty much free fall, and this was another bad week for gold stocks, further dropping below some key what used to be support zones. There doesn't seem to be kind of an end in sight here for this continued gold drop, even as we're seeing higher inflation. Fear, we kept hearing about how fear would drive investors into the precious metals, doesn't seem to have happened. And again, the underlying stocks are continuing to get crushed. What's your outlook for the precious metals?
So, well, are you asking me for the precious metals itself, for gold or gold stocks?
Let's start with gold individually, then we can get into gold stocks quickly.
Okay. So gold is getting closer to where it's had multiple lows in the past, which is about 1675. Right now, gold futures trading 1703 late on Friday. There are multiple lows in and around 1675 over the last couple of years. So we've gone from the top of the range multiple times this year. Gold traded up to and even above 2000, trying to test the all-time highs from the summer of 2020. Every time up above, let's even call it 1975, it failed. We're now getting down towards the lower end of the range. So that doesn't mean I come in and start buying gold, you know, at 1700. From a timing perspective, we could still be several weeks away from the bottom, and maybe we take out the 1675 low just to, you know, put in a spike bottom. But in general, I guess I'd tell you that I'm more inclined to be a buyer on weakness now than to continue being a seller. Technically, it looks lousy. It broke the three-year uptrend line from kind of a accounting point of view, where we look at specific relationships to how the market trades, and timing would suggest perhaps another 3-4 weeks of downside pressure. But in general, if you like the story of gold, but realize that it's not something, it's very hard tactically trading gold. It's very choppy, and a lot of times, you know, this is really what they call a paper market. There's the futures markets for gold control the price, but not the fundamentals. And if you concur that there's still a good reason to own gold over time, then you have to deal with sometimes periods of months, if not years, that gold is not going to do for you what you wanted it to, in the sense of further moving up in price. But as you said, Corey, it has been a decent hedge. Gold is down on the year now, but it's not down anything like the stock market's down. It came into the year near, I don't know, 1800, something like that. You know, so it's down to 1700, but it's still doing better. So in the case of a hedge, yes, it's been a hedge. That's kind of, you know, on gold, I'm still holding my gold for long term. I don't trade gold typically in a short term. I generally, gold is something I've wanted to have in my portfolio for years and years and years, and it's just a very small piece. So it's just a piece of a whole bigger view. When you look at, let's say, GDX, which is the Market Vectors Gold Miners ETF, the most popular of the gold miner ETFs, this broke some very important support near 29. It's trading 25 and a half-ish. Right down here, for those who are more technically inclined, is the 62% Fibonacci retracement from the COVID lows back in 2020. This got down to, I don't know, $16 a share, something like that. And then it ended up going over 45 a share. The 62% retracement is at 25.15. We're trading at 25 and a half or so right now. And this week's low is 25.14. So we precisely tested that level. Doesn't have to stop here. It also suggests from a timing perspective that we could still trade lower and kind of keep a lid on things for the next month. But if you don't see any reason that this should take out the 2020 lows, then you're, again, you use this weakness over the next month or so to buy into and just position for a move back towards 30.
All right, Rick, well, I know that we're running out of time here, so we'll let you get out of here. But look, overall, it still sounds like a fair bit of pressure for these markets. Some very interesting comments in terms of what you use and bigger institutions use to judge markets. That's a key takeaway, as well as, again, it just sounds like we are in summertime and there could be some buying opportunities, but we're also getting very close to some key levels that different sectors need to hold. We'll follow up with you in about a month's time. I always enjoy hearing what you have to say, Rick, and I will post a link so everyone can find out a bit more about some of your letters and your service. Rick, thank you again for taking time with us on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. We always appreciate hearing from you.
Corey and Chad, thanks for having me. We'll see you in a month.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.